Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have Greg Berard. He's a conservation biologist and marine biology instructor from Central Campus, downtown Des Moines. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
And Jessie Lowry is here. She is our director of conservation and research. And you're going to get the show started today.
I am, Ryan. Thanks so much. Glad to be here again today. And I like to always set the stage and talk about what a zoo can do to save animals and kind of set the stage. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. And what I really see it is a window to the wild, a place where we can invite the community and families and schools and students at Central Campus to come in and see the amazing beauty that nature has to offer. Look into the eyes of a snow leopard, see an eastern black rhino up close, something that maybe many of us won't get a chance to see these animals in the wild. And then we all get that sense of awe when we see these beautiful creatures. But our job as a zoo is to turn that sense of awe into a real conservation action, a real behavior change, something that is going to make a difference to the environment and to wild animals all over the world. And so Blank Park Zoo does conservation or saving animals in many different ways. One big thing that we're really ramping up now is to be as green, as sustainable as we possibly can in our day-to-day operations. And we encourage the public to do so as well, and our visitors. Something else that we do is work really hard to take care of our local environment. If you want to get the most bang for your buck, taking care of Iowa and the Midwest and our native species is really important. We remove plant species, invasive plant species from local parks. We encourage people to plant butterfly gardens. And those are some of the big projects that we have locally. But the real backbone of what a modern zoo can do to save animals in the wild is the in-kind and financial support of field projects. Those people and organizations that are out on the front lines, protecting oftentimes animals that we have here at Blank Park Zoo. And so we give funds and support to International Rhino Foundation, saving rhinos in every country of which they exist, Giraffe Conservation Foundation. We send staff to the field to work in Namibia to help attach radio collars to giraffes so we can learn how they use their environment to inform management practices. But really, the main point of this is that just by visiting Blank Park Zoo, you're helping to save animals in the wild, because a portion of every single dollar that we make goes to In the Wild conservation. And so every employee that works here and every person that walks through our gates is helping to save animals in the wild. And I don't know about you, Ryan, but I didn't know very much about the Nautilus.
I thought it was a submarine.
It is an amazing creature that Greg is here to talk to us about, and something that a lot of people don't know about and something that definitely needs our attention and our protection. And so, again, Greg, welcome to the show. We are very excited to have you here today.
Thank you. Thanks, Jesse.
So let's start, Greg, by just talking a little bit about your background and your role at Central Campus, and then we'll start talking about the Nautilus.
Yeah, so long story short, you know, I wanted to be a marine biologist since I was four. Squid interested me, and I just followed that road all the way in through school, ended up getting my PhD, and now I'm studying the chamber nautilus and trying to protect it from overfishing and some different things. And I moved to Iowa to kind of look at conservation from a different perspective and try and inspire the next generation of high school students here already interested in marine biology to see where they might take themselves in the future. So I've been here in Iowa at Central Campus since 2014 and been trying to progress the program and trying to just give students the opportunity to become scientists at such a young age.
So when you were four, five, six, 7 years old, thinking that you were going to be a marine biologist, you didn't probably think that you were going to move to Iowa. Is that right?
I did not. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, so you know, there wasn't much water around, and it was just happened to be watching a documentary, and that's the only thing that connected me to the marine world. And it doesn't have to be much. It might be a documentary. It might be a zoo or an aquarium that you visit. It just has to be that one thing that really connects you and gets you motivated for life.
And so what was it about squid?
I don't even remember. I think it was just the fascination that there's this weird animal. It changes colors. It has arms and tentacles, and its mouth is like a parrot beak. So it's a really strange animal that we didn't know too much about, and I just wanted to learn more about them. And it fortunately took me to the Nautilus and has taken me now around the world to try and protect them.
And that's what it's all about. And that's, we agree that connecting people to nature, you know, and all the guests that we have on the show have their own story about what really, you know, opened up their eyes and their passion to nature and wildlife. That's what we try to do here every day at Blank Park Zoo. And that's what you're doing when you're teaching your students at Central Campus. We want to make those experiences for folks so they can grow up to be conservationists, you know, and make a difference in the world. So let's talk about the Nautilus. It is an extremely unique and interesting animal that I would assume many of our listeners really don't even have a mental picture of what it looks like. So please tell us a little about this very unique animal.
Right. And I like to call the Nautilus the most mysterious, well-known animal because you probably don't know what the animal looks like. But if you think of the shell or you look around you, you see the pattern in architecture. You see it in math. You see this spiral pattern. So we're kind of aware of it, but we don't really know it. And they are related to octopus and squid, which more folks are probably aware of. The Nautilus has been around for almost 500 million years, which predates mammals, it predates birds, it predates most things on the planet. And it's just been around living deep in the ocean, just doing its own thing until about the last 50 years or so, where humans were really trying to start to catch Nautilus for a new market in their shell. And you might see the shell in shell shops. It's made in different things like earrings and necklaces because it is very beautiful. It's a unique item that folks love and they want to have. So it's something that is definitely easy to fish, easy to sell, and something that's been happening for 50 years or so.
And so this is commonly something that you would find when you're on vacation and would perhaps be an earring or some kind of piece of jewelry that's made out of the Nautilus shell?
Yeah, and Nautiluses are found in the South Pacific, but you see the shells in places like Florida, California, any coastal town with a souvenir shop, you'll probably see a Nautilus shell or an earring made out of the Nautilus shell. So it's a worldwide demand for this animal that we really don't know too much about.
So tell us what we do know about the Nautilus, and you said Indo-Pacific is where it lives. Talk about its habitat and some of its behavior.
Yeah, so the Indo-Pacific is the area that is kind of defined by Australia, the Philippines, Fiji, and Thailand. And it's the Western Pacific Ocean primarily. And Nautiluses live very deep, so they can live as deep as 700 meters or 2,200 feet below the ocean surface. So way too deep for us to dive to find them or learn more about them. And within these habitats, they do some interesting things that we're just learning more about. They migrate daily to find food. They're searching constantly for prey and constantly for potential mates. And the big thing that really concerns and impacts their fisheries is when they find a mate, they don't become mature until about 12 to 15 years old. So that's very similar to other large animals like elephants, rhinoceroses, and it's very different from all other cephalopods. And when they do become mature and they find a mate, the female lays up to 10 eggs, and the eggs take a year to hatch. So just looking at their reproduction strategy, if you're a fishery and you're fishing these animals out, it's going to take them a long time to rebound from that pressure. So their life history strategy just doesn't make them an ideal candidate to fish without understanding more about their population sizes.
Why would you think their life history pattern would differ so much from other cephalopods?
So that's an awesome question, because I think it's one of the reasons that Nautiluses have survived all these mass extinctions. So when ammonites or ammonoids came on the scene millions of years ago, the Nautiluses went deeper and deeper. And the ammonites are another shelled cephalopod that grew fast. They lived in shallow waters, but they didn't survive the last mass extinction event that wiped out the dinosaurs. The Nautiluses did. And one of the thoughts to that is that they adapted to this life in the slow lane, going deeper, just doing everything much slower. And so they were kind of insulated from a lot of these environmental changes in the shallower waters. So just them moving deeper probably allowed them to survive through these mass extinctions. And it's what allows them to survive today without human impact and human take.
And I'm sure just because of their body form and their shell, that's, you know, what would be left in the fossil record and how we can know so much about its history.
Yeah, and it's so great that they have that external shell, because It's hard to fossilize any animal as it is, but if you have this really hard structure made out of calcium carbonate, it's going to fossilize a lot better. So you can see fossil nautiloids in Iowa. You can go all throughout Iowa and you can find nautiloids because Iowa used to be at the bottom of an ocean. For most of its history, Iowa was actually underneath an ocean, and over time it became submerged, resubmerged out of the water, submerged again. So there's a great fossil record in Iowa of nautiloids, but a lot of marine creatures.
So they're found in, only a certain place in the world, and they've got this very distinct behavior, and, we still have so much that we need to learn about them. But what do we know so far about their predators? What else are they contending with that right. deep in the ocean?
Right. So nautiluses are maybe about 7 to 8 inches in diameter, so they aren't overly big. When they hatch out, they're dime size. So predators are large fishes, large sharks. And a unique predator that seems to be a predator throughout its entire range is an octopus. So its cousin, the octopus, seems to prey on nautilus pretty heavily. And we notice this because we find little octopus bore holes that they make in the shell. And so from that perspective, it seems like anything big enough to actually crunch the shell of a nautilus can eat it. So they do have many predators out there that are playing their own role in controlling the population. So it's not just those predators, now we add fishery take to it, and now we also are adding all this other kind of information to it and stressors on it that we're seeing changes in the populations.
So talk a little bit about the pressures that these fisheries are having on this animal and what it's doing to the population.
So what we do know about fisheries is that within 20 years, if there's a nautilus fishery that keeps going, that fishery is going to be crashing within 20 years, and sometimes within 2 to 3 years. And by crashing, I'm meaning that the fishery is not going to be sustainable. There's no nautiluses left. And the real kind of bummer to that is the fisherman loses as well, because when that fishery crashes, the trader moves to a new island, hires new fishermen, fishes out that population, and then keeps moving to a new island to fish them out. So we know wherever you fish nautilus, they disappear within 20 years at the best case scenario, but sometimes within just a few years.
And how much is a nautilus shell worth? We know that a rhino horn is worth more than its weight in gold. Do you have any sense of how much these are being sold for on the market?
It kind of varies. So anywhere you can search on eBay or things, anywhere from $10 to $200, $300 US. The fisherman only makes about a dollar from this at that stage. And then as it goes up the chain, then that's where you see the increase in the price. And depending on what somebody wants to do with the shell, you can polish it. So you get this really mother of pearl layer, kind of like a pearl or an oyster color. So it's really shiny. Those might go for $500. And there's even some shells now being marketed as one of a kind shells that have these natural scars on the shells made from just things in the ecosystem of the nautilus that are being priced higher and higher because of these scarring events and these kind of one-of-a-kind individuals. So it varies, but the real strange thing is the fisherman just gets a dollar at that stage.
And with different products in the wildlife trade, including ivory and rhino horn, we've got everything from highly organized syndicates that are, connected throughout the world and all the way down to, just folks that are trying to eke out a living for their family. So can you talk about the people who are going out and fishing for nautiluses and, their culture, and are they fishing for kind of whatever they can find? And if they get a nautilus, they go and they sell it, but they're also collecting other things from the ocean. How does that all work?
Right. And one of the great things about doing a lot of this work is, especially in the Philippines, we work with a local fisherman. And right when we started working with him, we're just the same. He's going out to catch nautilus to provide for his family. He wants to send his kid to college. He's doing similar things that we do in the United States or other places around the world, but just the environment, the resources are different. So they do target nautilus as a fishery, but they're also fishing for other things, because the way you fish nautilus is you set traps overnight and you just let them sit there. So oftentimes at night, you might fish for something else. In the daytime, you might fish for something else. Because you don't fish for nautilus in the day. So they do try and get nautilus. They might catch them as bycatch as well, but most of them are really trying to target that nautilus shell.
How has your work helped prevent that
So one of our goals is to regulate the trade. So again, we're approaching this as a, you know, we want to make sure that these fisheries can be sustainable. I mean, if those these folks want to use these resources that way, that's great. But the way it's happening now is they're just being fished out and everybody's losing. So we've been doing a lot of work to try and get Nautiluses regulated through this international organization called CITES, which regulates things like the ivory and the rhinoceros horn. It tries to set rules in order so that there's more of a traceability and more of an accountability of what you're doing to the population. And it's easier said than done. We're just in the initial stages of kind of seeing what the new regulations mean that have been enacted and kind of making folks aware of these new laws and these new kind of directives and how they can benefit from it. Because that's the hopefully the goal of conservation is how we can all benefit the animals, but also the humans involved as well, because there is a big human perspective in all of this and we can't lose sight of that.
So basically there's going to be a catch limit and a reporting process?
Yeah, that's the idea, is that, you know, we can work in some populations and just see what a quota might be. It's pretty common in the United States fisheries for lots of fishes. There's quotas set for certain species. They change. But until we get things put in place and until we understand what the thresholds are, if there even is a quota that could be set, we really don't know. And it's really hard to kind of get into a culture that's been fishing these for 50 years. Their dad, their granddad fished them, and to kind of change their perspective on what they're doing to help promote conservation and help save the resource that they're using.
And so it sounds like, you know, one of the things that we need to lay the foundation with data as far as where these animals live and how many there are and how deep they are. And so tell us a little bit about some of the exciting research that you've been a part of.
Right. And one of the really cool methods that I think is so impactful that we're using are these underwater camera systems, where we set video cameras to about 1,000 feet deep, and we're recording the number of nautiluses that come to our bait. And our bait is usually just raw chicken. And this is great for science because we can calculate how many nautiluses are in that area. But it's also great from an engagement standpoint of really interacting with the community by showing everybody what's down there. Yes, there's nautiluses down there, but there's also sharks, there's shrimp, there's so many things in the deep sea in this ecosystem that folks, nobody's really studying. And when you see that impact of what's down there, that's when you get the buy-in, because scientists can talk about their data all they want, but at one point it is just data. You have to be able to share that story in a different way to different folks, and this underwater video helps us do that. Now, the flip side of that underwater video is we're also seeing the impact from humans in another way, that we do see, you know, trash items. We see bottles, plastic bags, and 1,000 feet of water that, you know, decades ago we wouldn't see. So we're talking about protecting nautiluses and looking at this deep sea ecosystem from a fishery perspective, but then we're also seeing all this other stuff happening in the deep sea that could be impacting not just nautilus populations, but all animals down there. And how does that, you know, impact us?
We hear a lot about plastics in the ocean, and I heard recently there's big islands of plastic floating in the ocean. First of all, does that have a direct relation to the nautilus and harm the nautilus? And second, could you fill us in on some of those things that are happening with plastics?
Yeah, and I think the plastic islands is, to me, when I think about that, I think about these big islands, bottles and bottles and bottles. And I think it's a little bit of a misconception. There are these big rafts of plastics, but they're mostly really tiny plastics. And that's really the worst case scenario, because when plastics break down, they break down to something really, really tiny. And then tiny animals eat those, and those tiny animals might die. So the predators that prey upon them have no food source. So I think from a perspective of these big island rafts of big plastics, it's not really what it is. And we're just learning that, you know, these plastics are in the deep sea. We know that nautiluses in captivity sometimes will chew on different things if they're in the tank. So the likelihood of them chewing on plastics, just like all other animals eating them, is probably pretty high. And if they come across it, you know, they will probably try and eat it. But, you know, until we can kind of get this fishery perspective kind of under control, we really can't even address those other questions about it, because without getting fisheries kind of controlled and regulated, the nautiluses are going to be gone, and then we can't answer those questions. So we know it's a big issue in lots of other animals, and I'm sure it's a big issue in nautiluses.
Their food source, what do they eat, and is that food source stable?
Again, it's a great question, and we know they eat things like hermit crabs based on some gut contents analysis. We know in captivity they eat things like shrimp, they eat meat, they eat lobster molts, they eat lots of different things, and we think the only thing they eat is dead prey items. And so finding dead prey items in the deep sea is really hard. So they have these really big olfactory organs or noses that helps them search out these dead prey items. But we've never really seen nautiluses eat live prey or find prey in natural settings. But everything we see from our work is that they're digging through the sand, they're going through the sand searching for prey. Now, if you try and connect that with humans, even though nautiluses live in the deep sea, this deep sea is really close to shore. So when you live close to shore, you have things like coastal runoff. You have rivers emptying out all these things into the ocean. One of these things is nitrates and nutrients, and all of these things are going down to the deep sea. So as nautiluses continue to kind of search for food and dig in the sand, what else are they digging into? Are they digging into toxins? Are they digging into things that will hurt nautiluses? Potentially. But it's just another area that, you know, we just don't know much about yet, because we're focusing so much of our efforts on just trying to stop them from being overfished.
I think the story of the underwater cameras is just extremely fascinating. Take us through a day in the life of a researcher, really putting those cameras out into the ocean, and tell us how exciting it is when you get those images back.
Yes, it's exciting when you get the images back. It's very stressful until that point, but you know, we call them baited remote underwater video systems. And so they're this big rig. It's about 3 feet in diameter. And we take it on a boat. We head out to sea. And we try and toss these overboard into the big ocean at about 1,000 feet deep. And they're mounted with these underwater cameras with the housing that record about 12 hours of footage. So we try to set everything at about 6 p.m. or so. And then we go to sleep. The next morning, we come back out, pull everything up. It takes about an hour to pull these really heavy cameras up, and then we're able to look at what's on the video. And that is really the cool part, because, you know, it's a little tiny camcorder, but we still all gather around and, you know, fast forward through some clips, and then we see a nautilus, or we see a shark, or we see a seven-armed octopus down there. And it's just the things you see are so different every single time. And, you know, the idea of, you know, we don't really know what's in the deep sea is really true, because every single video we get has something different on it. And it's just, again, more data and more value that we can put to this nautilus research and the whole deep sea ecosystem.
How would you answer the question, what would happen if the nautilus went extinct? You know, that we have so many unanswered questions of how it uses its habitat and, you know, what it eats. Why should we work so hard to save it?
All right. I think the nautilus are an important indicator species, and I think they indicate real big problems for us. You know, they've been an animal that's been around through all of the mass extinction events in the past. They've survived it somehow. So if nautiluses were to disappear, I think it would mean a sign of everything disappearing, because humans, we just haven't recognized the impact we're having, and we haven't dealt with the potential solutions to these problems. So nautiluses, you know, from an ecosystem standpoint, they're one of the biggest scavengers. And scavengers are important for converting that dead food, that detritus down there, that energy back up the food chain to feed those top predators. So without those scavengers eating all that energy and being eaten themselves by big predators, the predators lose out on prey as well. So it does have an impact from that perspective. And I think just symbolically, if nautiluses disappear, it means, you know, we've given up or we haven't tried hard enough to actually protect them.
So tell us, how do we save the nautilus?
I think the best way, and it sounds corny, is just to tell somebody about the nautilus. I mean, it's awareness, it's education, it's just sharing the nautilus story. And, you know, of course, I would not suggest folks to buy Nautilus shells or anything, but just sharing the story and getting it out there. That's the way it started with whales. It's the way it started with elephants. You know, it just starts with folks telling the story and folks getting excited about it.
And, you know, even the problem of plastics in the ocean and overconsumption of single-use plastics especially can seem very doom and gloom and very, very depressing. It is something easy that we can all do. And so even if you live in Iowa and there's no ocean nearby, if you want to save the Nautilus, you can decrease your use of single-use plastics. And that's something that we can all easily do in our own lives. Do you want to talk a little bit? We've just got a couple minutes left about the organization that was started by a couple young people.
Yeah, so the organization that I work with, Save the Nautilus, was created in 2012 by two 11-year-olds, Josiah and his friend Ridgely. And they read an article that one of their grandmothers had sent them, and they decided then that they wanted to do something to help. And they created this website, and they started talking to their school, and they started doing interviews, and they started doing all of these projects. And over that time, you know, from a resource perspective, they've raised over $30,000 for this research through just other kids helping out. And I think it goes to show that if you reach that kid or that adult, if you reach that person in a way that impacts them, the things they can do are just incredible. It's just a matter of putting the information out there so folks are aware and folks have the opportunity to make those changes. So they have just been hugely instrumental in all this work.
We just have a couple minutes left, and a couple years ago I was able to take a tour of the marine biology department down at Central Campus. And if you could, just in 1 to 2 minutes, we'll have to have you back for another show to delve deep into this, but tell us about the marine biology program down there.
Yeah, it's an incredible place. I mean, it's what brought me to Iowa, just the ability to work with different animals from around the world and learn about them, looking at them rather than just in books, is just what zoos and aquariums want to do, because you see that connection, you see the animal, and then from that, you build upon messages. You build upon, you know, you don't really need that straw. You build upon, you know, what about the reusable cup? You build upon all these different messages. And the program just gives students a chance to become marine biologists, to learn a little bit about marine biology, or just take a fun class that they're interested in. And it truly is a student-run laboratory and aquarium. Right now, it's the summer, school is out, and the students are running everything. They're there feeding. When it's winter, when it's Christmas, the students come in to feed everything and take care of everything. So they are really marine biologists and aquarists when they're in the program.
Well, that's very interesting, and thanks so much for joining us. I learned a lot of new stuff today that I had no clue beforehand.
I want to save the Nautilus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website, blankparkzoo.com, and you'll learn all about our events and fun stuff at the zoo. Well, we'll see you next time on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.